Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge and we're glad to have you listening. Today, China has one of the world's most dynamic economies. It will host next year's Olympic Games and has become, with the United States and Europe, an important partner in working to resolve international conflict. Now, if maybe just as little as 20 years ago, you said that's where China would be today, few would really believe that the country could become so important in such a relatively short time. This morning on Focus 580 in this hour, we'll be talking a bit about China, about the way it looks today, and perhaps about how it might look, let us say, 20 years from now. And our guest is Daniel Bays. He is professor of history and head of Asian studies at Calvin College, and that is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He was for a number of years professor at the University of Kansas, where he was a professor of history and director there for a time of the Center for East Asian Studies there. He's here visiting the campus. We're pleased to have him with us to spend a little time talking. And, of course, questions, as always, are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you want to be involved in the conversation, just pick up the telephone and give us... Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
It's my honor.
I think that it would be correct to say that if you look at where China is today, and then you go back, whatever kind of point you want to pick, right before World War II, right after World War II, after the revolution, after the Cultural Revolution, you know, at various points, I think that you would have to be surprised or at least take note of just where China is now and how far it has come from any point virtually along that timeline.
Yeah, you're quite right. If you only go back less than 30 years to the late 70s, nobody would have predicted that China, which was weak, stagnant economy, almost a very underdeveloped society, lousy educational system, would have been anywhere near where it is today.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose that also makes it difficult, or does that make it difficult to say, well, if we're surprised how far they've come in 20 years, to say, well, just to pick a number to say, well, what about 20 years from now? Can anyone really say with some confidence where China might indeed be 2027?
Not with any confidence, but one can sort of play around and project things ahead that have some chance of coming to fruition. Today, the rage is to talk about the rise of China. That's sort of a key word that appears in a lot of discussions of China today and maybe where it's heading. Sort of pick something off the shelf randomly at a bookstore, you could find books with sort of the following titles: China Incorporated, How the Rise of the Next Superpower Challenges America and the World; China Shakes the World, a Titan's Rise in Troubled Future and the Challenge for America. Here's a very good book by Rob Gifford, just came out, China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. There are dozens of books that talk about the rise of China, emphasizing the economy for the most part, but beyond noting the dramatic rise of China, there's the question of where that rise is going, and especially what kind of a society, political structure, social structure, and value system is going to be involved here. Of course, that's much harder to predict, but people do it, and I'm a historian, and historians are a little uncomfortable going too far into the future. But it's sort of challenging and interesting to think about these things. And I have friends that are more real China watchers in terms of keeping up on day-to-day events than I do, because historians don't have time to keep track of everything going on immediately. But I talk to them, and we debate. And I have a particular interest in the ideology, culture, religion. So I'm concerned with that. But I take note of the social, economic, political factors, too.
Well, you have to, and if you put a title like that on a book, that's going to help it sell. You have to pitch it in that kind of terms. But having said that, again, you have to acknowledge the fact that, yes, it has been very dramatic. So perhaps you can ask this question. If you just look at the at what has happened, say, within the past couple of decades, how the country has changed, particularly how the economy has grown. And so you have the question, well, what made that possible? Can you point to one or two really key things?
Yes. I go to China at least once a year. Probably been more than 20 times in the last couple of decades. You really have to take it back to the late 1970s. Mao Zedong died in 76. The Cultural Revolution is viewed as ending in 1976. It took a couple of years to sort out leadership and who's in charge. And then the famous Deng Xiaoping took over in 78 and immediately launched what became known as the reform and opening policies, turned Maoist ideas on their head, policies turned them on their head, reversed many of them, decollectivized land, opened the economy to the free market, and fairly quickly legitimized private property, capitalism for most of the economy, and a much greater openness and education, students going abroad, and dramatic upgrading of China's own educational system, especially higher education. So dramatic changes which paid off in economic growth, which has been so remarkable. I first went to China in 1979 and then started going frequently in 1985. And just from year to year, the changes have just been constantly huge and sometimes actually mind-boggling. The last time I went back to Beijing just a year ago to spend the fall with 15 Calvin students, and the old Beijing Municipal Museum had been in an old building which I was familiar with. I went there and took the students there, and it wasn't there anymore. It was in a new, stunning architectural gem of a building on the main street in Beijing, Chang'an Street. And it was designed by some European architect, just a stunning building. And that change is just one small one in a constantly changing landscape of China.
Mm-hmm. There certainly has been this dramatic economic change, economic reform, or I don't know, maybe you don't want to use that word, the change of economic system to a Western-style market system. And with that, rising expectations on the part of a lot of people, and for some people, those expectations being satisfied. One of the things that we've seen certainly is a significant growth in middle class, and something that I think a lot of people expect will continue to see. So on the one hand, we've seen all of this rapid economic change that has not been accompanied by as much change in the country's political system. It is still an authoritarian one-party state. So one of the things that people speculate about is, in future, is it likely to see, are we likely to see change in the political sphere to the degree that we have seen in the economic sphere?
No, in a word, you're quite right. There's been basically no change on the political side. And the present leadership, just in even as we speak, the 17th Party Congress is going on in Beijing, and Hu Jintao, the president, has made it clear right from the start of that Congress that there's not going to be any significant or even hardly visible political change. The Communist Party is just so paranoid about power, and yet there will be some evolution, not great change in Communist Party leadership, but some scope for rule of law and some protection for citizens. It's got to happen within the next 20 years. To me, in my own interests, which are just to study Christianity in China, that new middle class has got an articulate, sort of cutting-edge spokesman or spokespersons in the form of some very courageous civil rights and human rights lawyers, mm-hmm. who have been willing to take on some interesting cases and try to establish some boundaries for the arbitrary actions of the state against citizens, in this case, often Christians. But sometimes the lawyers, who are themselves Christians, will defend people accused of fomenting labor unrest, and the defendants are not necessarily Christians, but the lawyers are, and they, out of Christian convictions, take on cases and risk being punished by the state themselves. Sometimes lawyers, if they're too good defending their client, will actually be imprisoned for a time by the state as punishment for presenting such an effective defense. So just to establish a bit of rule of law in that area is quite a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Let me just introduce very quickly our guest again for this hour of Focus 580, Daniel Bayes. He's professor of history at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's head of Asian studies there, also for a number of years taught at University of Kansas, and has been following China for a long time. He's here visiting the campus, and certainly questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that also I think is very interesting is this in China is the urban-rural kind of divide.
Yes.
People, generally, I think it's true that the people who have prospered within the past couple of decades tend to be urban people. And that most of China is still rural, and a lot of those people are poor. They haven't really seen the advantages of the economic boom, not to the extent that a lot of people living in the cities along the coast, for example, right, have. And it seems that here's been a force, to the extent that people can, to really place more demands on the government. To the extent that there have been political unrest and demonstrations that have been put down, yes, with force by the government among country people. Is that something that has the potential for being a force for change?
It's a potential force for disruption and chaos, because by the time some change came, the system would be straining so much at the seams that it wouldn't just change, it would probably explode. The urban-rural, middle-class, lower-class divide is huge. You're quite right about the middle class in the cities. Last year in Beijing, I read that while there, the government was a bit concerned because the middle class is buying cars at such a private automobiles at such a rate that 1,000 new vehicles per day were entering the streets of Beijing, just Beijing alone. And so they need all this frantic infrastructure they're building. And the increase in income has been almost entirely urban. Disparities of income, inequalities of income have increased hugely in the last 20 years. And even in the cities, there's an underclass of rural migrants who come in and work on a construction project, etc. But in the countryside, the people that aren't strong enough or young and able to go to the cities and work, they're stuck in the countryside. They're really poor. And the disparity between the poorest out-of-the-way villages in the hinterland and the upper middle class working in computer engineers for Microsoft or Intel has just become immense. And then on top of that, there's a few Chinese billionaires who have, through entrepreneurship, some luck, and just being good businessmen in the last 20 years have made sort of mini Bill Gates and mm-hmm. Warren Buffetts. So China's social structure is under great strain. And you're right, in the countryside, the signal for that, the result of that is a lot of peasant unrest. Peasants get really angry when they're taxed and exploited and pushed around by the local officials, and they are. They're treated like dirt by the local communist officials. Some rule their counties like medieval fiefdoms.
Mm-hmm. That's it. I would think that would be a difficult. You know, given that historically, at least as far as the Communist Revolution is concerned and Mao Zedong thought is concerned, the idea always was that the farmers, the peasants, were the bedrock of the society.
Absolutely.
How does the Chinese government defend, or do they defend the conditions under which now these people that, you know, it had been dogma that, you know, this is the solid bedrock. This is the thing that the entire society is built on, that their lives are so difficult.
This is one of the great ironies of recent Chinese history. And Chairman Mao would not be pleased at these developments. The peasantry was the foundation of the communist victory. And in the 1980s, in the Deng Xiaoping reform era, one of the first things that was done was to actually give attention to agriculture and the rural population. Decollectivization took place. I frankly never thought, if you'd asked me in 1976, will China ever decollectivize its collective farms, its communes, the state ownership of the farmland? I would say no. They never do that. They did it right away after 1980, and made it possible for farmers to have control over a long-term basis, not full technical ownership, but control on a long-term basis of the plots of land that they had, and even made them hereditary. And this increased farm incomes. Peasants were better off in the 1980s. But then in the 90s, the benefit ended, or the increased benefit ended in the countryside, shifted to the cities with manufacturing. And that's when in the last 20 years, the middle class in the cities has taken off. Life in the countryside has gotten worse in the last 20 years. It improved in the 80s, but in the last 20 years, it's gone downhill. Health care is much worse than it was 20 years ago in the countryside. Education is worse. And there's no safety net. China still has no equivalent of Social Security. So farmers are dependent on their own kids. Their own kids have, many of them picked up and moved to the cities to work there, where they work for low wages, but they still manage to save quite a bit and send it back. If you work in a factory in the cities without a permanent residence permit in the city, you're a guest worker. You're vulnerable, you're exploited, paid poor wages, lousy working conditions, but you're much better off than on the farms. Mm-hmm. And so we're in the middle now of this massive population migration from countryside to city. It'll involve 250 to 300 million people by the time we're done. We're about halfway through it, maybe two-thirds of the way through. Probably at least 150 million people have already, in the last, say, 10 years, move from countryside to city, and at least another 100 million will in the next 4 or 5 years. Right. It's hard to imagine the size of this population migration. And so there are a lot of poor people in cities as well as middle class and a lot of poor people in the countryside. And this is what does the Communist Party do? They recognize the problem rhetorically, but 5 years ago they decided to let capitalist business owners in the party. So what do you have here? You have a party which represents the workers and peasants, the Communist Party. So they're turning over authority and status in the party to the exploiters of the workers, the factory owners, business owners. Chairman Mao must be just turning over in his grave.
Yeah. We have a caller here I want to bring into conversation, and let's do that. And someone listening up in the northern part of the state, in Geneva, line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Yeah. I was wondering a couple of questions would be, what would you think would be the reason why China is growing so fast, and what would be the reason why we're not, and are they going to surpass us as being the number one economy in the world? Versus, you know, what it's been for the last, 100 years or so.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of good questions on it. Now, our guest is an historian and not an economist, but I'm sure that you have some thoughts about both those questions.
Well, I think one clear thing is that one reason China is growing so fast is that it had such a low point to start from. The Chinese economy in 1978 or 79 was at such a poor state that... And yet there is all this tremendous labor power, and what was needed was investment. And China had a long way to go with the economy. They opened the country to foreign investment. Foreign investment poured into China in the 1980s and since at an incredible rate. So there's the investment, the raw material, all the labor force is there, present, underutilized. A lot of people were, in effect, unemployed in China because there wasn't enough work for them. And with this labor supply, the investment, and China having the good sense to set aside these enterprise zones, that helps largely explains the takeoff. Whether this will continue and China will replace the U.S. as the number one economy, it might, as the largest economy as the total figure, but probably almost certainly not on a per capita basis.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Let's go. We have somebody else here, so we'll go right to them. Line one, this is someone in Urbana. Hello?
Oh, yeah. Hi, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting that I've listened to you guys, the economists, talk about this, about China and the growth of China, and which is really interesting because it has just, it's amazing what's happened in the last, let's say, 10 years. But one of the things I find real interesting is when I call, Galbraith was on and a few other people, and we talk, you know, he talks about the overall economy, and I keep asking people about the environmental problem in China, which ostensibly, by just the literature that's public, if you look through the the environmental literature or the economic literature or just the satellite data, et cetera, I mean, China is a disaster, and it's worsening probably by the year or maybe by the decade. And once again, you speak of the 600 million or whatever, there are 800 million people that are basically on the starving or, you know, farmers or whatever. They don't have jobs and all this stuff. But the environment is continually destroyed like they're doing it now. They ostensibly are because the air pollution in California, like a third of the particulate matter in California on the West Coast, originates from China. So what is that doing to the Pacific? I mean, and if you look at the perimeter satellite data from the oceans off the Chinese coast, the effluents in there are hideous. They're poisoning their whole continent. I don't quite understand. We sit there and hear this literature. I mean, you speak about this. Well, people ask questions about, well, what will it be in this? I mean, where's the environmental part of this equation? How come, you know, the Chinese government doesn't seem to do anything about it other than pollute the hell out of everything? I mean, they have no controls on their coal-fired plants. I mean, I could go on and on about this.
Yes, yes.
Seems to be anything about that.
Well, an excellent point to raise.
That's a very good point. If I were making a from-scratch lecture and covering all of China today, I put a lot on environmental disaster, which is involved here. Environment in China is terrible. Environmental policy is terrible. The central government is just now starting to recognize the severity of the problem and just taking at least some token steps towards remedial action. But the problem is that the central government doesn't control that much at the local levels. You wouldn't believe the collusion between polluting plants, manufacturing plants, say paper pulp plants, plants that make paper and have all this waste from pulp. It's terribly toxic. And they discharge it into streams and rivers. And the local officials are part owners of the plant. They're not going to cooperate with the central government directives to clean up the mess. This happens a lot. Scrubbing equipment is put on a smokestack. And it's there, nice new scrubbing equipment. It costs a lot of electricity to run it, though. So when the inspectors are not there, the equipment is turned off. And then the local factory has a spy in the local government or the regional government that lets them know when the inspectors are going to come. So then they turn it on just before the inspectors get there. But 95% of the time, the equipment isn't on. The effluent gets kicked into the stream, just as always, is a terrible problem, and China is irresponsible in this, and yet they don't want to recognize the problem as they should because they say we're at an early stage of economic development. It's only a mature economy that can be careful about the environment, which is nonsense, of course, but it's a very big problem.
Just very quickly, I want to introduce again the guest, Daniel Bays. He's an historian. He's professor of history at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He's also director of the Asian Studies program there. He was, for a number of years before going to Calvin, professor of history at University of Kansas, where he also was for a number of years director of their director of the Center for East Asian Studies there, and has been following events in China for some time now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I think as people think about what's likely to happen here over the next couple of decades in China, you know, a number of scenarios are presented. One would be for a very progressive change. One would be for things to really not change very much, to essentially kind of stay the way they are. And then a third possibility would be people who would point to the kinds of things that we've talked about here, the potential problems, the environmental problems, rising expectations of this growing middle class, the problems that come with this internal migration that you've talked about, that's particularly a move from the country to the city. Another thing that I think a lot of people are concerned about that feeds back into the other problems is corruption in government, and so forth. And some people say that if you look at those things, there's great potential for disruption and chaos and upheaval. I don't know that anybody's talking about there being another revolution, but that's going to be – there is a potential for a lot of conflict. And it seems that there's at least as much chance of things going that road as there are of there being some kind of more progressive and peaceful change. And what do you think about that?
I think that there's a good chance that some of these problems will constitute an explosive situation that could easily get out of hand, and there would be some chaos, some disruption, and it might even shake Communist Party rule. I think it's a minority possibility, but maybe 30% possible. These are big problems, and these protests in the countryside are extensive. They're really. And this gives the Communist Party the basis of its argument that you have to stick with us, let us have monopoly of power, otherwise there will be chaos. The Chinese term luan is often used, meaning chaos. It's used to refer to the Cultural Revolution in retrospect as a disaster because it was chaos. And, you know, do what we say and keep us in charge, or there will be chaos. And so that they use that argument that way. The scenarios for the future, probably the most likely one, but not by a huge margin. The most likely one is a continuation of a authoritarian, bureaucratic, one-party state, but with remarkably large number of social and economic freedoms for that degree of political authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. And there also very likely will be continuing inequality with some remedial work done for the people at the bottom of the heap. The present leadership, Hu Jintao, is portraying himself as a man of the people who understands the poor. That's his public image. So inequality will remain. And whatever regime it is, present authoritarian one or a more liberal one, Chinese nationalism and patriotism will be very strong. Mm-hmm. That's an important thing to assume for the future. That China's pride in things like the Olympics, its role in the six-party talks on North Korean nuclear stuff, China's ability to put a wonderful snow job on the rulers of Africa and have much improved relations with Africa. Of course, so that involves some very sleazy things in Sudan and Darfur, of course. But China is very, and will be under any regime, very conscious of its sovereignty and its glorious history, and continually aware and willing to remind the West of those 200 years when China was exploited and oppressed by the Western, by what they call Western imperialism, mm-hmm. in which they're perfectly right in that. So those are some of the features that any regime will have in the future.
Let's talk with another caller. We have, in fact, one ready to go and one, I think, getting lined up. Next is someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Over the summer, my sister went to visit Western China, the non-Han part of China. She visited the Uyghur area.
Right.
And she said she was really surprised at how open and vocal people were about their hatred of the Han and how they would really like to break away. And so I'm wondering, what you know, what the chances are that at some point in the next few decades, there might be a breakup of China as we know it, just as what happened in the Soviet Union. And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the question.
That's a really good question. Unfortunately for the Uyghurs and the Tibetans, who are the two minority groups that really would like to be independent, there aren't enough of them, and the Chinese state is too determined to maintain control. You're right. Out in those far western regions, which are still majority Uyghur in composition, all the Chinese immigration is proceeding steadily and has already in some areas changed what used to be a 80% Uyghur, 20% Han Chinese to a 40% Uyghur, 60% Han Chinese. Gradually that's happening all over the whole area. But there's still a lot of areas that are mainly Uyghur. And there, this, I haven't heard this with my own ears. I haven't been to the far west in China. But friends tell me, and what I read, people are remarkably candid about their disgust and hatred for China and their wish to be independent. But or at least autonomous. But there's an East Turkestan independence movement run by a few Uyghurs, which shot off a few bombs several years ago and blown up some buses in West China. One of the results of the post 9/11 policies around the world is that the U.S. has essentially given the Chinese the go ahead to really be tough on the Uyghurs, and so since the last 4 or 5 years, the Chinese have really tightened up on the Uyghurs on the excuse of this East Turkestan independence movement. Of course, the Chinese are paranoid about this and are overplaying the threat. I don't think that the Uyghurs, they don't like Chinese rule, but they're not able to throw it off. Mm.
So there as the caller points out, as you say, there are in various places in China groups of people who are ethnically different from the rulers, from the Han Chinese. They are the Uyghurs and are also Muslim.
Yes.
And then we have the people of Tibet. So those are the most visible instances of people who feel that they've been taken over, essentially, by
colonized.
The Chinese. Colonized. But that was almost the word I was getting ready to reach for. Colonized by the Chinese, who would, if they have their way, be independent, but at the very least would like greater autonomy. That's just what the Dalai Lama, who is here visiting the United States, just recently said. He tried to make a very strong point that even though that the Chinese accuse him of being backing separatism, and he said, no, that's not true. What I'm arguing for, what the people of Tibet are arguing for, is autonomy, not independence. So here there are these two places where this is really very visible. Are there, though, other groups of people in any sort of significant numbers that would pose that kind of challenge, at least?
No.
No.
The other ethnic minorities, of which there are 55 officially, but actually probably more like close to 100, are really small and don't have the wherewithal to, and don't necessarily have a desire to be independent. They wouldn't know what to do with independence, and even autonomy is difficult for them to manage with their own resources.
Yeah. So the strategy that the Chinese have taken, I know the strategy they've taken in Tibet, is to do what they can to dilute Tibetan culture, yeah. and also what they've done is that they've taken a lot of Chinese people, ethnically yep. Chinese people, and settled them in Tibet. So yes. I guess what they would like to do is make the Tibetans a minority in their own country, or at least you know have enough Chinese in there so that that would dilute any sort of political power that the indigenous Tibetan people would have.
Yeah, that's exactly their strategy, and the other strategy is to simply wait until this present Dalai Lama dies, and then the Chinese regime will be in a position to dictate, oh, this is the next Dalai Lama, mm-hmm. this kid here, whom we have chosen, instead of the normal methods of choosing the next Dalai Lama.
Well, surely the people of Tibet wouldn't accept that person. I don't imagine they accept the Panchen Lama, who was essentially the Chinese. This is the number two,
right?
The number two guy, and the Chinese have someone that they have picked and said, "Well, this is the Panchen Lama." I don't think the people of Tibet hold much truck with that.
But from the Chinese point of view, it's better to have that than to have one that's actually chosen by the Tibetan methods. The Chinese figure that they can get some more leverage on Tibet this way. Yeah, the Tibetan situation is really, really frustrating and tragic.
Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign County. Line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple of things. One thing is there was a little argument the other day going back to sort of environmental issues, the crisis of the planet. Discourse to coal burning plants opened a month or is it a week in China? I forget now. But there's an Englishman on a climate scientist who's saying that they have English studies that say that if you look at the so-called development, the export industry, this explains a large portion of the demand for energy that is causing the pollution, basically. And there was big response that, you know, no, it couldn't be us. You know, it couldn't be our demand for cheap Chinese goods marketed by Motorola and whomever, American and other multinationals. There was just an irrational response. I mean, one can argue the point. And I'm just wondering whether you've ever thought about something like that. Whether that looks real to you. The other thing is, and then I'll hang up and listen, is this idea that the Africans are being duped. A lot of Africans don't like the Chinese influence, but what has anyone else offered? Millennium Challenge was the Bush administration's, and for the first 3 years, all they did was build a marble edifice in downtown D.C., and even now, they have some things that they can say they've done, but it's very little impact on the people. I don't think Chinese are really supporting an authentic development plan, but they're doing a little bit more, and I don't think that the Chinese, the African peoples need to be noblesse obliged, if you were. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, these are a couple of good points. When you look at China's energy, you quickly realize that China has been either blessed or cursed, as you might see it, with a lot of coal, tons of coal, I mean, huge coal deposits. And they had hoped that they would have a lot of oil, but the oil hasn't panned out. So China has become a net importer of oil, imports substantial amounts from Saudi Arabia, and from the Sudan, which is why the Chinese won't pressure the Sudanese government to let up on Darfur. So they've got the coal, and that's what they've got to work with. And so the result is that from a human resource point of view, 50,000-60,000 miners every year die in Chinese coal mines. Maybe that's too high. Maybe it's only 20,000. It's an astounding number of Chinese coal miners die every year. And of course, that coal goes into coal burning electric plants, and it's very, very, very dirty stuff. Your point about Africa is right. If I used the word duped, and I probably did a few minutes ago, that I think was unfair, because you're quite right. The Chinese have poured a lot of money into projects in Africa, and although the infrastructure they're building is largely, frankly, to get the raw materials that they want to get from Africa out and onto ships. It is infrastructure which will have some benefit to these African states and their populations. And the Chinese are doing other things besides just things that will directly influence them or benefit them. They're doing health things and education things, and continue to give African students full scholarships to come and get educated in China. Other people aren't doing nearly as much as the Chinese, even though what the Chinese are doing is partly for their own benefit.
Hmm. Let me ask you, because just to be clear, and you might want to weigh in this, although not being an economist or environmental scientist, I don't know if you would, but the caller is referring back to a conversation that took place on an earlier program with an earlier guest, particularly between the guest and the caller, about this issue of pollution in China, what it means to China, what it means to the world. And sort of the two points that were being argued were, on the one hand, the guest, who was in a sense making the argument that the pollution in China is the result of industry that manufactures items for export to the rest of the world. And so in a sense, they're saying that the Chinese have to bear the brunt of the pollution, but the benefit in terms of the products we get. So in a sense, the West, the people who are buying the products are in a sense causing the problem. Someone called in and said, well, I'm not sure that that's right, and sort of raised this question, well, how much of the pollution that's generated by industry in China is for products and services that are consumed by the Chinese? So in the sense, it's not, you can't blame the West for the problem if what they're doing is that they're making, for example, they're making cars that will be bought and driven in China. Is there a way to take that apart?
There probably is, but my instinctive answer is that there's some merit to that hypothesis. Because the amount not small industry, but light industry making consumer products for the West is immense. But the cars, the heavy industry, and a lot, increasing amount of the light industry is for the Chinese domestic market. The Chinese domestic market is growing very rapidly, and I think faster than exports. So a portion, but I think a minority, maybe 20% of 10% of the pollution problem, maybe traced to Western consumer consumption of Chinese products, but not anywhere near a majority of it.
I want to go back for a moment to talk about something that you were talking about before. I think before we took the last caller, that I think is interesting. And that is about nationalism in China. And I certainly think that it is true that there are a lot of Chinese people who feel that, based solely on the kind of power that their country has today, economic and political power, it needs to be acknowledged as an important player on the world stage. If you layer that on top of those people who would say, historically, there have been times when China was a major world power, no doubt about it. I think that there would be probably people in China today, particularly younger people, who would have very strong feelings, very strong nationalistic feelings about China, and feel that it's perhaps its place in the world is not acknowledged to the extent that it should be.
Well said, frankly. You put your finger on a very important thing. That's exactly the view of a lot of young Chinese. And this has huge implications for relations between China and the rest of the world, including the U.S. I mean, it's very unclear whether China is going to be, in the next 10 or 20 years, an ally, a friend, a rival, an enemy. And that U.S.-China relationship, and all its uncertainty, is crucial to our future and theirs and the rest of the world's. And the China's relationship with Japan is also crucial, maybe even more important than that with the U.S., because Japan is so close. So Japan is uncertain about its military future. Will it remilitarize more than it has? Will it ever have nuclear weapons? Will it revise its war clause? A lot of this has to do with China. And China's future policies depend a lot on what Japan does. So all these things are very much up in the air, too.
Mm-hmm. Right now in China, they're holding the Party Congress, 17th right. Party Congress, and that what will happen is the Congress will select people to the various levels of leadership
right. So
that the delegates to the Congress, they're going to elect a new central committee, and the central committee will elect a new Politburo, and at least according to everything that I read, it's very likely that one of those people, some member of this new Politburo, will then become the next president of China. It will take office in 2012. So people who follow Chinese politics very closely, I'm sure that they're watching this process, which is, of course, it's difficult because it's really all takes place behind closed doors.
Yeah.
So you really don't. You really don't know until the announcement is made.
Yeah.
Essentially, what's going to happen? Is there anything that one can learn though from looking at what it is we can actually see that's going on here that might then tell you something about the future direction?
Well, the main thing is who appears in that final group of the standing committee of the Politburo. The identity of the Central Committee itself is chosen by the top leaders, and with maybe the possibility to replace one or two if it turns out that there's a protest against them, you know, quietly. And and who's going to be on the Politburo is chosen, and then the Politburo does meet, and will probably choose nine, again the same as now, to be on the standing committee, which is the real power center. And it's just plain uncertain now.
Hmm.
And I don't know how we can find out except by leaks to some journalist, you know, who the number two to Hu Jintao is going to be. It's fun, though, to watch this stuff. It's fascinating.
Is there within to the extent that we know, within the Chinese leadership, are there different, you know, significantly different factions or different groups of people who really have different ideas about how they would like to see things go?
Not much. They're distinctly different factions, but they're largely power-related, not policy-related.
Mm-hmm.
There are, however, people, if you go to the whole Central Committee, who would be more liberal and willing to have, perfectly willing to have a more pluralist China, more dissent, more freer press and rule of law. Some people like that in the Central Committee, but maybe probably not on the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
Just as a way of finishing up here, we have a minute or two left. There are, I think, people who are very concerned that if you look ahead in the future and you ask this question, what nation, is there a nation that would have the potential for being a serious rival, not just economically but also militarily, to the United States? And I think for a lot of people, they would say yes. The answer to that question is yes, and the country is China. And, you know, I suppose you can make a lot of this or not so much. What do you think about that, particularly this string of thought that says yes, we should expect China to emerge as the main rival to the power of the United States?
In the Pacific area, I think that's true. China's economy is becoming, in some ways, a rival to the U.S. Militarily, worldwide, I don't think so. China doesn't have that ambition, I think, worldwide. And technologically, 20 years from now, China is still not going to be where the U.S. is technologically in the military sphere. So I'm not worried about that.
So even if we push it out, is that just having to speculate so much that you just can't? If we'd say, instead of saying 20 years, if we say 30, 40, 50 years, is that just too far even to say anything about?
For me, it is.
For,
yeah, as a historian.
As a historian.
I'm a little uncomfortable at 20 years, at 40 years. I think my brain would freeze up.
Well, I appreciate you spending some time with us and talking today.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you very much. Our guest this morning is Daniel Bays. He is professor of history and head of Asian studies at Calvin College. That's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And before taking up his post at Calvin, he was, for a number of years, professor of history at the University of Kansas. He was here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and was good enough to spend some time with us, and we certainly appreciate it.